Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Frederick Taylor is a founding father of organizational studies. His scientific management approach has surely touched many aspects of your professional life, as you will see. He was a mechanical engineer and a management consultant. That meant that he was an outside person that would come into organizations to try to help them make things better. Factories at the time were springing up everywhere, and standardized ways didn't yet exist to manage large groups of people and handle increasingly complex work. So Taylor saw this need and he wanted to step in and make organizations more standardized, efficient, and productive by studying their work processes closely. Scientific management is the term he used. He did a lot of studies and wrote books about it. It's basically meant applying science to work, studying tasks carefully, systematically at the micro level to speed up work. He wanted to break away from the common sense rules of thumb that he saw as unproven and inefficient. So workers had their own self-styled ways of doing things that they would pass around. And he said, hey, there's really no way to know if this is the best way to do things. So let's study it. Scientific management is also known as Taylorism, which of course is named after him. Division of labor is a practice that he believed in. He wanted to divide work processes into very small, simple, and separate steps, division of labor. And that meant instead of doing a whole project where you did it from beginning to end, you would only do one or two little steps, and then the next task was performed by the next person. So this is a very different way to do work at the time. He wanted to determine the one best way, a standard to do every part, every task, to boost productivity. That's what he's really known for, looking for that one best way to solve the riddle. He also believed in hierarchy. He wanted a clear chain of command that separated all the employees at the bottom of the organization from all the managerial people toward the top. And the reason he wanted to do this was that he wanted the managers to design the work process and enforce how that work was performed. Employees, as a result, would just follow directions. They just became doers, and the managers were then the thinkers. He believed in selection and training and compensation in a way that was a little different at the time. He wanted to select and train high-performing workers, or what he called first-class employees, and then match them to a job that was best suited for them. He saw this as the ideal. And he believed that the most productive workers should be paid more. He thought, on average, that most employees were not very hard workers, and he didn't have a very high opinion of employees. And he wanted to get rid of those people, and if they couldn't meet the higher standard, he would fire them, and only the good people would be left. His method was called time and motion studies. That meant he wanted to figure out the least amount of time, on average, it took to perform each task and even each part of each task. He really broke it down. What were the fewest number of motions required for each small task? He wanted employees to basically work like they were machines. As I mentioned, he was a mechanical engineer by training and background, and so that's what they do. They design and build machines, and he wanted people to act like that. His shovel experiments were a great example of a time and motion study. And so the idea here is, he said, hey, you know what? Instead of just using whatever shovel, why don't we figure out the exact amount of poundage a shovel should hold to make work the fastest? So he did experiments where he took 10 guys and he lined them up and gave them all a pile of sand or coal. And he said, I want you to take this shovel, which held about 26 pounds, and move your piles from here about 10 feet over to there. And so they worked at it all day, and he kept track of everything with a clipboard and a timer. And at the end of the day, they went home. And then overnight, he cut off a little piece of metal off of each shovel so that it was about a pound lighter. In other words, it held about a pound less of coal or sand. And then they came back the next morning, and he told the workers, okay, remember those piles that you moved? Now I want you to move them back to where they were in the first place, which was probably a little frustrating for the employees, but they were getting paid, and so they did it. And he did this every night and kept taking a little bit off of the shovel until he saw the number peak. And every time they took a little bit off, the numbers went up. Then he noticed that he kept taking more and more off the shovel, and then the numbers started to go down. They were actually finishing their piles later in the day, each day on average. And so he said, oh, maybe we've passed the midpoint. So he went back to slightly larger shovels, and sure enough, the numbers went in the right direction again, and he settled on 21.5 pounds. That was the perfect amount of sand or coal that you should fit in a shovel to move the most amount in a given day. So that amount meant you could move it faster because it was a little lighter. It also meant that you could take fewer trips. So if you're using a really small shovel, you'd have to use more motions, more trips to the pile. So he figured out the ideal amount of time and motion for shoveling. And that's why, by the way, if you go into any hardware store, you're going to see all kinds of different shovels, shapes, and sizes. And this is all influenced by Frederick Taylor, his experiments, and his thinking, certainly by extension, after that. But it's not just shovels. You see this everywhere. Like today, in fact, if you go to a sub shop and order a sub, at the end of the line, they're going to ask you if you want anything on it, like mustard. And they pick up their dispenser and they do about 3 swipes across to put that mustard on. And then they kind of look up at you like, oh, is that enough? And you decide whether or not you want more on there. There's a competitor, however, that has a nozzle with 3 spouts on it. And that means that they do 1 squeeze, 1 motion across, and now the mustard or the ketchup is done. And so they're saving 2 motions. They're saving just a couple seconds on that one little step, but they're able to make that sub a little faster. Now, if you break down the process of making a sub into 20 or 30 steps and you figure out a way to speed up each of those tiny little steps, how to cut the bread, how to put the meat on, how to put the lettuce on, how to cook it, etc., now you can crank out more sandwiches per hour with fewer employees, more sandwiches per day total, and you're making your company more money. And it's not just subs. If you go into just about any fast food restaurant, especially the franchises, you're going to see that they have figured out a very quick method, the one best way to make almost every single product they make. If you're making one burger versus two burgers, for example, you don't make it the same way. You have to increase your productivity. So you see this just about everywhere. The guy who took this to the next level was Henry Ford. Of course, he's the founder of the Ford Motor Company, and it's still in existence today, still thriving today. When he first started making cars, the car stayed in one place, and they did a little bit of time and motion studies on it, but it still took them about 12 hours to make a car from start to finish. The workers were all working around the car. And then he said, hey, let's really go crazy with the time and motion studies. And then he said, let's also make an assembly line. He didn't invent the assembly line, as they say, but he did perfect it. And so they just kept studying the process as much as they could. And they took a car from 12 hours, which is what it took to make it at the beginning, all the way down to 93 minutes. They got it just right. They say at its fastest, there was a new car rolling off the end of that assembly line every 11 seconds. It's just incredible. Boeing recently changed over the way they made their 737s. They actually used to make it in one place, like they originally did with the cars. And then they moved it into more assembly line style, which they call a lean production, where the plane rolls along with all the tools and even the workers inside just a few feet an hour until it's done. And from start to finish, they were able to almost triple their production rate. That's a lot of savings for the company and a lot of savings for the client. The outcomes of Taylor's work are mixed. On the plus side, he absolutely helps people boost productivity by 200, even 400% or more in some cases. So that's a big win. More work accomplished with fewer people meant more profit for the companies and a more consistent product of arguably higher quality. So let's say if you break something on your car, you can get an exact duplicate that fits in perfectly. You don't have to have a handmade piece, which would be incredibly expensive and not necessarily higher quality. On the other side of the coin, there are some outcomes that were not so great. Companies often failed to pay employees more. This is a central part of Taylor's advice. You have to pay people more because you want to hang on to the best people and you want to keep them motivated. And he recommended they do this. Ford took that advice and he paid people double the going rate at the time, which is one of the key reasons that Ford had such great people and thrived. Most companies, however, did not do that. Managers think, employees do was a philosophy that became normal. Separated workers from the greater meaning of work. So if they're only tightening a bolt or painting a screw, then they're not really connected to that broader satisfaction of making a whole product anymore. It de-skilled employees and made them expendable. You could find and replace somebody in just a few moments. You didn't really have a lot of skill or time invested in each person. Survival of the fittest philosophy really took over. That harsh atmosphere resulted where it was a very cruel and unfeeling atmosphere. Employee burnout, that dehumanization of being treated like a machine, and the mental anguish that came along with this mundane and repetitive work were all part of this experience. So Frederick Taylor, one of the founding fathers of organizational studies, has clearly influenced many aspects of our work today, and that's why we study him.
Today's It's My House is titled Soul Train Meets the Toyota Way. Soul Train Meets the Toyota Way, 619-768-2945. If you're a regular listener, you know we've been playing a lot of audios dealing with factory production, particularly coming out of China. But the first audio we played today told a little bit about Frederick Winslow Taylor, who a lot of the Japanese basically got a lot of philosophy from him. He was an American. We're going to play another clip by him, but we're going to mesh it into Don Cornelius because Soul Train. Well, I'll tell you how we mix the two in. But Soul Train initially was out of Chicago, but when he went national, he had to put together like a network of eight markets to get that off the ground nationally. So we're going to talk about meshing these two concepts together. The way I'm thinking, one and the same is just different products. And then how we'll be expanding here on It's My House. One thing about the Taylor thing, and I think the guy mentioned it in audio, at first when they were putting it together, it took, I believe he said, 9 hours to put together one. 9 hours to put together one. Then by following the production methods that Frederick Winslow Taylor was talking about, and which is, I mean, Taylor was before Toyota, but the Toyota that we know today at least. But the Toyota way, and I'm putting it along with Taylor as well. Well, it's essentially break down or deconstruct the process down to its most simplest parts. So that's what Ford did. So he went from 9 hours to producing one Ford, Model T, down to 93 minutes. Down to 11 seconds. So we want to explore the same thing with what we do with media as well as what we have to do offline. Anyway, let me matter of fact, this next clip, just to lighten it up a little bit, will be somebody did a film about the first taping of Soul Train, so we'll play that, then we'll end it with going back to Frederick Winslow Taylor.
All right, ready, camera two, take two.
Soul Train, the hippest trip in America. 60 non-stop minutes over the tracks of your mind. Today's guest, Gladys Knight and the Pips, Honeycomb, and special guest, Eddie Kendricks and the Soul Train Gang. Now here's your host, Don Cornelius.
Just in time for the first trip on the Soul Train. If the sound of soul is your pleasure, then what's your treasure? You can bet your bottom we got them, baby. After a message from Johnson Products, three talented sisters are going to look you dead in your eyes where your beauty lies.
And we're out. Back in tank. All right, guys, back up. Let the ball through.
No, wait. Let it go. I like it. That's the baddest line dance thing they're doing to the set. Those right now. Tell Tessa that I want the best for the board. Yes, Mr. Cornelius.
Unit A stage left, be on the right. It's real, guys. Don't hold back.
I'm so nerous, I don't know what to do.
Nerves are good, it means you're ready. That shirt has seen better days, though.
Oh, you don't like it?
The question is, do you like it? There's a stash in the back. Come on.
It's almost showtime.
It'll take 2 minutes. Come on.
Easy on the makeup, Tammy. Natural, not glam. Gotcha.
Oh. Now this is cute.
You don't think it's a little skimpy?
No, it makes you look like the star you are.
Try that on. I'm gonna go find a belt. Kendall, you all right?
I don't think I am, Miss Tessa.
Good as you dance, I wouldn't let a little nerve get to me. Only a few million people will be watching.
Millions. For real.
Hello? Somebody help me! Some people live their entire lives and never get a chance like this. Enjoy it.
I will.
Good. And I need my best on the scramble board.
For serious.
Segment 6, you and Simone. But first, let me introduce you to the world. Places, people. Make mommy proud.
Hey, hello. You see my sister?
I think she went to go think.
And we're back. Quiet on set, quiet on set. All right, here we go. 5, 4, 3.
Look out, it's the honeycomb. Sure enough, rocking back, and that ain't fiction, baby. It's a natural fact.
Benny, I don't want dancers in my shot during the intro.
Yes, sir. I'll reset the marks.
Donnie. This is Frank Asher, TWA. Tyler Hodge, Corning Kitchenware. And this is Dave Bryant. He's from Coke.
Girl, this is the craziest thing I've ever been part of.
Glad you guys could come by. Hope it won't be the last time. Hey, I'll tell you what, this is amazing. Just as Brooks promised, fans stand for colors. First time ever.
Like, look at that. It's just a sea of blackness. Hmm. Man, don't you just love it?
Brooke, yes, sir. Take care of these boys. Anything they want.
Aye, aye, Captain. You say we get another drink, huh, boys?
Hey, I'll drink to that.
I sure could use another scotch.
We need the dancers in place for the scramble board.
Anyone got eyes on Kendall and Simone?
Freshen, I can handle the board.
Okay. Benny, Simone Fresh got the board.
All right.
Come on.
Somebody please get me out of here. Hello?
Simone, what are you doing?
I'm going to kill that sketch.
Rob, we don't cut.
Hey,
what is going on here? I don't know what you think you are, but this ain't the hood. You don't rumble on my set.
Flo tried to lock
me. I don't give a damn what you tried to do. Every time that camera stops, it costs me $1,000. Do either of you have $1,000? You make a mistake, you keep dancing. You break an ankle, you keep dancing. I don't care if you have to piss your pants, you keep dancing. We will cut around it. Are we clear? Are we clear?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yes,
Mr.
Cornelius. Good. We'll take it from the top. And we're back. Cue the music.
Hello everyone, and welcome to Mr. Simplify's tutorials. In this video, we're going to look at Taylor's scientific management theory, which is another motivational theory that we are looking at in this channel, in addition to Hertzberg and Maslow's motivational theory. Now, Taylor's scientific management theory is very different to, say, Maslow's motivational theory, because it looks at things in a very autocratic way, in a very employer-oriented way, which obviously you look at, you'll understand through the course of this video. Now let's look at a little bit of an introduction for this theory. Now Frederick Taylor's theory emphasizes efficiency by focusing entirely on monetary benefits, or rather should I say focusing entirely on employee productivity and then rewarding these employees who are productive monetarily. So that is like the fundamental basis of Frederick Taylor's scientific management theory. So the mindset is very employer oriented, and it was originally used in manufacturing by Taylor, but it is actually practiced to this date very sparingly though, and you know why. So if we break this down further for you, the scientific management theory suggests that projects or assignments should actually be broken down into components firstly, and then workers or employees, should I say, should be given very specific tasks based on their competencies, and their efficiencies should be monitored at all times. So basically, in a very mechanical way, typical to Taylor, the role of each worker is fixed. So each worker is given fixed repetitive roles, and is basically made to function like a cog in a machine. So the roles are fixed, the same tasks are repeated over and over again, and the greater the efficiency of a worker in such a state where repetitive tasks are provided, the greater is the financial rewards, and vice versa. So if a worker is efficient, he or she is given great financial rewards, and if he or she isn't, then the financial rewards are cut down drastically. So the concept of a basic pay, you know, which builds up on the basis of experience, etc., experience or loyalty, are all taken out of the equation, and it's sort of like a dog-eat-dog situation where the more productive you are, the more you're going to get paid, the less productive you are, the less you're going to get paid, and possibly going to be replaced. So it also emphasizes the basis of an organizational hierarchy based on efficiency. So the more efficient you are, the more higher up in the hierarchy you are, and the more you shall be respected and paid, and vice versa, obviously. So it basically looks down on people who are identified as being less efficient and looks to actually get them replaced by workers who are more efficient. So to make it easier to remember, we can actually look at this diagram here and look at three components which form the basis of Taylor's theory. And the three components are monitor, measure, and control, leading to efficiency. So the workers need to be monitored at all times, their efficiencies need to be measured, and then their outputs need to be controlled, their actions need to be controlled. So at all times, a worker needs to be supervised, a worker needs to be allocated specific tasks, and the worker is expected to perform those specific tasks efficiently to provide productivity for the organization. So what matters and what doesn't matter for businesses according to Taylor's theory? Only productivity and efficiency matter. Nothing else matters. There's no emphasis on initiatives taken by employees or innovations by employees. All of these things don't matter. It's only productivity, efficiency, and just doing what is being told and what is expected of an employee. Employees are only motivated by money, according to Taylor, and the money is paid per unit of output. So we basically operate on what is called as a piece rate. So there's no emphasis on initiatives, and employee motivation is only linked to financial rewards, and employees are paid on the basis of a piece rate. So you probably have guests so far. You probably have guests so far that this sort of motivational theory isn't really applicable much in the modern era. But you would be surprised that there are actually manufacturing units which still try to follow the piece rate practices, and obviously are highly criticized. So if we look at the applications in the modern era, it's actually very impractical for obvious reasons. It's extremely autocratic. The benefits are short-term because employees can be psychologically demotivated and stressed because of doing repetitive tasks and menial tasks and never actually feeling like they're given any sense of control or any sense of autonomy. They're always monitored, they're always being told what to do, and they're always being accounted for. And this obviously results in high employee turnover rates. But if we look at an example, there are certain manufacturing units in China which have been criticized in the past for piece rate policies, for using Taylor's theory to actually structure their organization, basically. And retailers from the Western world, Primark for instance, have been criticized in the past for using the services of such manufacturers. So as you see, Taylor's theory is called the scientific management theory, but it is actually a very autocratic theory based wherein the entire control is based on monetary rewards, and the whole of the control of the organization, the reins of the organization belong to the management, and the management focuses entirely on efficiency and productivity to generate output. Okay, hopefully that was easy enough and simplified enough for you. Hopefully you found that useful. I thank you very much for your attention to this video, and I thank you for your continual support to this channel so far. I recommend and I encourage that you spread the word, you like the videos, like content on this channel for more future content. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day. Cheers. Bye.
The slogan behind me reads China's shoe capital. This is Xinjiang City, once a manufacturing base for the likes of Nike and Adidas. It is now dubbed the shoe capital of the country. We're going to go and take a look inside.
After China started opening up its economy in the late 70s and the doors to overseas investors in the 80s, Xinjiang thrived by making shoes for foreign companies. Over the past 40 years, local businessmen have steadily acquired the skills and money they need to build their own brands. Now, the city is home to an estimated 5,000 shoe companies, including three of China's four largest sportswear brands, Anta, Xtep, and 361. Some wholesalers in Xinjiang think the Fujian giants have the potential to be international names.
We're here at Xtep's headquarters, just down the street from its much larger rival, Anta. We're heading in for an exclusive tour to see how they're expanding with their latest technologies.
In this running science laboratory, we invite our elite athletes here. We do a full evaluation of them, capture their foot shape, know about their biomechanics, know about their footwear needs, customize their footwear for them for their competitions. For our mass consumer, we usually invite our recreational runners to come over here. So for our motion analysis, we get them to run within our laboratory in our loop. We collect data, analyze them, we get to know their functional needs. We have 3D printing to create prototypes as well for testing, for review, and for design. Our strength is to build highly functional products at a very affordable price.
In terms of market share, Chinese sportswear brands are still far behind global industry leaders like Nike and Adidas. But they're making great strides into international markets, sponsoring athletes, as well as buying up brands like K-Swiss and Wilson, or partnering with labels such as Wolverine. With all this science and innovation that we've been speaking about, do you think you have the potential in the future to become as big or overtake Nike, Adidas, those brands?
I think to overtake, I think it's quite soon right now because we're still focusing in China. But right now we are really focused on running. I think in the area of running, we have the chance to compete with all other brands in the world.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe. But they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yuba. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yuba builds its own parts on site. So Mr. Huss' supplier is only a bike ride away.
3000个，赶快送过来。哦，这边没有了，已经没有了。是。
But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
反正大概因为现在生产线已经停掉了，然后我大概要赶快把它送过去哈。好的，七点钟准时安排送料。对。
Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day.
好，谢谢。
When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yuba started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but Yuba wants more.
好，停止，停止！加油，看齐，小心，看，站好，好，好，好！
Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war.
好，停止！动作快点，地板叫人打一下，然后地板脏兮兮的都不会打，先叫上来给你。后面的快点！By
next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, six production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. Huh finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang Yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly line. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism.
I'm a ref being chased out of town after the worst game of my career. You forget one down and the whole stadium turns on you. And if you have credit rate insurance, it may not pay for all this. So get Allstate. You can save money and be better protected from mayhem, like me.
Shop less, get more. Make one call to an Allstate agent.
The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only 2 daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work. And there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job.
workers at UPA are married to the company. Based in southeast China, UPA is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of UPA and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of UPA's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of UPA jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply
depot.
The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make UPA more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to UPA in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
UPA management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, UPA could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products.
It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin, and Li needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop.
I'm a ref being chased out of town after the worst game of my career. You forget one down and the whole stadium turns on you. And if you have cut rate insurance, it may not pay for all this. So get Allstate. You can save money and be better protected from mayhem, like me.
Shop less, get more. Make one call to an Allstate.
Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork.
That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, he still didn't have much food to eat.
Now, food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasoning that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby.
Yeah.